go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Welcome to Car Stuff. My name is Ben Bolin.
And I'm Scott Benjamin.
And we covered that this is Car Stuff.
Yeah, I think, well, maybe not, but it is anyways. Ben, you know, we talk about a lot of different things, right? We talk about things, well, just fast things. It doesn't have to necessarily be car stuff, right?
No, not always.
But in a roundabout way, this is. It could be.
It very well could be.
But I think the topic is something that a lot of people have an interest in. It's jet-powered vehicles.
That are not jets.
Yeah, that's we should clarify that. Not jets because, of course, jets are jet-powered. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about everything else out there.
Mm-hmm.
The oddities, I guess, that you find.
Oh, and some of them are odd. Of course, as you mentioned, Scott, some are cars, and we'll talk about those.
Yeah.
Some are finger quotes cars, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose that's the best way to put it.
And then some are things that you will hopefully be surprised to learn about.
Maybe, yeah, I think so. But you know what? Let's back it down just a tiny bit here, mm-hmm. and let's go into just a little bit about what a jet is, really, because I think some people have a little bit of confusion mm-hmm. about how a jet operates. And maybe the parts of a jet or the different types of jets out there.
That's a great point. Now, we know that the first jet-powered aircraft was built in 1938. So jet technology has quite a history to it.
I got to say, that you just mentioned that before the podcast.
Yes.
And that kind of blew me away that 1938 we were already flying jets.
Yes, sir. That's, well, we flew the first one. You know, that's like saying the Wright brothers, we were already flying aircraft.
Yeah, I understand. There was experimental vehicles that were operating at that time. But 1938, that's really early. I mean, obviously pre-World War II, but amazing. I think 1938 is a long, long time ago.
Now, it's the Henkel HE-178. We wanted to give a nod to that historic first, and now we want to talk a little bit about what a jet engine really is. What do we mean when we say that? There are a couple different types.
Oh, the components. You want to talk about the types, the components? Because we can do both, I think.
Let's do both.
I guess the way to get into it is that the types of jets. So you can find a turbojet.
Mm-hmm.
There's a turbofan. There's a turboprop, and now there's something called a Eurojet.
Mm-hmm.
Eurojet are the ones that you'll find like in not only in jets themselves, but also the kind that are. Hopefully going to power the latest land speed record vehicle, the Bloodhound SSC.
Yes.
We'll definitely talk about the SSC and I guess more so the Thrust SSC that currently holds the land speed record.
Yep.
So let's get into that later. But mm-hmm. There's four different types. So there's the turbojet. And this is what was in early jets.
Yes.
This is the one that they were noisy, they were loud, they were relatively inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of progressed on to something called the turbofan. And turbofan, there's a couple of different types. And this is typically the kind that you're going to find on current airliners.
Right. So when you go to an airport, you see the jets there, you're probably looking at turbofans. Those are the things hanging off the wings.
Exactly, yeah. And there's two different types. There's the high bypass turbofan. And the way they call it high bypass is that most of the air that goes through the jet goes around the core mm-hmm. of the engine. It doesn't go through the middle of the engine. About 90% of it, as a matter of fact, is bypassed. Only 10% goes through the core. The other type, as you can imagine, is called a low bypass engine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where most of the air goes through the engine core. I guess about half of the air goes right through the engine instead of
the majority.
Most of it being bypassed. So, I don't know. These are also the kind that you'll find in combat aircraft now, these days. There's a huge range of speeds, and they're very reliable. There's just a lot of good reasons why the turbofan is the one that we're typically used to seeing on vehicles these days.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly. It's a lot quieter. It's more efficient. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot going for it in not only in like civilian aviation, but also in combat operation.
Now, this might startle some people, but it is absolutely true. These are still combustion engines. These are still this is a general class of engine called gas turbine engines.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're talking about. So when we say a turbine, what do we mean? Well, excuse my accent. I apologize. I'm saying turbine, T-U-R-B-I-N-E, not the hat.
Turbine.
I should say turbine.
Tomato, tomato.
So you've probably heard of a steam turbine, a water turbine. Now, water turbine would be something that you'd see on a hydroelectric dam.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. And steam turbine, this you would find in nuclear reactors. So power plants could use coal or natural gas or a nuclear reaction to create steam, which turns a turbine, which generates the power, and then all of a sudden, boom, you plug in your television and it works. Also, windmills, my friend.
Windmills.
Windmills are a turbine, a wind turbine.
Really?
Yeah, because they use the wind to turn, instead of steam, the wind is turning the turbine.
Okay.
So it's not as though these gas turbine engines, you're right, turbine sounds much better. It's not as though these gas turbine engines in jets are specifically unique technology. This is, again, something that works.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to drive a piston.
Right.
In order to make it to make it work.
Now,
and these don't. I mean, they have these different chambers. I mean, if you want to talk about the parts of it.
Yeah, let's do that.
I mean, just off the top of my head here, real quickly. I mean, I am looking at my notes, but there's the intake, the compressor, the combustor, the turbines, and then the nozzle. Okay.
Yes.
Now, that all sounds like, you know, kind of foreign when you're talking about internal combustion engines, but trust me, this is very, very similar. I mean, the air comes in one end of the engine. Extrapolate this to the engine that we're thinking of, or we typically think of.
Yes.
The internal combustion engine in our cars. There's the intake, so air comes in. Mm-hmm. There's an area that compresses the fuel, which is, air at this point, and then adds fuel. Just after that, we add fuel just after the compressor, and that's in the combustion chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And so you add fuel to this compressed air. It's ignited in some way. There's a spark delivered somehow, you know, a timed spark. Actually, there's a continuous spark, I think, in this case.
Yeah, it's a flame burning continuously. So you'll hear this sometimes called a can or a flame hole.
Ah, very good. Because, you know, in a car, it's critical that spark happens at the exact right time.
Right.
In this case, you want it continuously burning. Because you're continuously compressing air and forcing it through this combustion chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it does combust, you know, of course, it expands, creates a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
That spins the turbines, which then thrust the air out the back end of the jet through an area that they call the nozzle that can be open, closed, directed, however you choose. And that causes – or that produces thrust. And thrust is very important. Well, that's really what makes this thing move. It's not like you're not driving – a crankshaft that spin, you know, that's connected to another rod that connects to a transmission that connects to, you know, et cetera.
Piston free.
Exactly. It's piston free. So the thrust is what gets you going. It gets you moving. This is like air forced out the back. It just makes a lot of sense when you look at it. You'll understand if you take a look at a diagram of exactly how a jet engine works. And if you break it down into these simple components, it's very, very simple to get your head around it.
And
it's a very complex idea, though.
It's a complex idea.
Yeah.
And like many of the great innovations, this complex idea can seem relatively simple.
Mm-hmm.
We should point out, in a shameless plug, that we do have an article on gas turbine engines.
Ah, yes, we
and
do.
This does have some great diagrams that can illustrate this process. A couple of good points about these engines. Gas turbine engines have a greater power to weight ratio than reciprocating engines, and they are smaller than reciprocating counterparts.
Yeah, these things are extremely powerful. I mean, we talked about thrust, right?
Yes.
Now, thrust is how they measure, the output of a jet engine, right?
Right, it'd be like pounds of thrust.
Yeah, exactly. So instead of a horsepower rating, which, although this is tricky because they do often give you a horsepower equivalent.
Yes, I'm glad you said that.
So, okay, let's just back through it here, though. I mean, the temperatures are very high in these types of engines.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very high. Like in the cool part of the engine, what they consider the cool part, the intake and the compression part, just the act of compressing that air drives the temperature up to something like 500 degrees Celsius, and that's considered cool.
And that is Celsius.
That's Celsius. Yeah, that's right. And you know, we get up to the area where they add fuel and fire, and then it's blown out the back. We're talking like 2,000 degrees Celsius, Ben. Now that's hot enough. I mean, I guess those listeners that are astute enough will understand that, you know, that's hot enough to melt the inside part of the engine. So how do they keep it cool? Well, some of the air, it all depends on some of the air that flows through the intake air is actually routed in order to keep it cool, and it prevents this flame wall from touching some of the components, and there's just enough of a buffer there to prevent the engine from actually melting itself from within. So yes. I thought that was pretty impressive.
I think that's ingenious design.
Exactly. Now let's get back to thrust.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay, so when we say a pound of thrust, mm-hmm. let's play with some numbers here, Scott. So if the metric system uses newtons, then 4.45 newtons, that equals 1 pound of thrust. Mm-hmm. And in our case here, for our measurement purposes, a pound of thrust is equal to a force able to accelerate 1 pound of material 32 feet per second.
Okay.
So that happens to be equal to the equivalent acceleration provided by gravity. So this all means that if you have a jet engine that can produce 1 pound of thrust, it could hold 1 pound of material in the air if it was pointed straight down,
Planes are pretty heavy.
Planes are way heavier than 1 pound.
Yeah, that's why this is different from a rocket engine, and the rocket mm-hmm. engine just expels all of its energy out as quickly as it can burn the fuel.
Yes.
This is a different scenario here. We're trying to propel yourself, I guess, parallel to the Earth, right?
Yeah.
Instead of directly away from the Earth. So, okay. The horsepower ratings on these things, when you start talking about the maximum output numbers, astronomical, right?
Yes.
I mean, we're talking like each engine may produce something in the range of like 35,000 to 40,000 horsepower, and that sounds absolutely incredible. But then you realize that a lot of that is effort that's just needed to drive the compressors.
Right, right.
The compressors, as a matter of fact. Now, this is crazy. Uh-huh. I'm going to read something here from a site. This is one that I think it came from the Bloodhound site, the Bloodhound SSC site.
Yes, sir.
Talking about the engine that drives the Bloodhound. The talks about the thrust that the engine produces. It says in the order of 35,000 horsepower is needed to drive the compressor. To put this into perspective, the total thrust of the engine is equivalent to about 40,000 horsepower, but almost half of the power of the jet is being used to drive its own compressor, with the remainder coming out of the nozzles as thrust. So,
amazing.
That's incredible.
I mean, that's amazing.
That's an amazing amount of horsepower required just to drive those compressors.
And I don't want to go too far into jet technology because we're supposed to be talking about the vehicles. We wanted to take a second and let everybody know some really cool stuff about this.
We'll get to it.
I
promise you. But there's just so much interesting information about these engines. I mean, they operate with this. Of course, you can imagine that there's a lot of electronics involved in these things.
There has to be.
There's a ton of electronics involved, and it's always continually checking and rechecking and deciding that, you know, this is safe, this is not safe, mm-hmm. this is a safe condition, mm-hmm. not safe. You know, should I continue to run? Should I run in limp-in mode? Should I shut myself down because I'm going to melt? Should I, you know, it's talking to itself, deciding all this, right? Well, one of the things that the Bloodhound group found was difficult was that they're dealing with an altitude, if you want to call it that, of something like 130 millimeters.
Yes.
So they have to convince what they're doing is they're fooling the electronic system that runs mm-hmm. these engines into thinking that it's running at a higher altitude or that it's safe to run at this low altitude because it's right on the ground, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different I guess, parameters that they have to set up in order to make this thing actually run. But interesting stuff. We'll get into that later with the thrust, I'm sure.
And also, one of the questions that naturally follows when we talk about this sort of technology is a question about fuel. How do you get these things to run? Strangely enough, kerosene. A very specialized, granted, kind of kerosene. We have civil jet fuels that are usually rated something like Jet A1 or Jet A, Jet B. These are distinct types of jet fuel that adhere to some international standards. Earlier we touched on the concerns about temperature, mm-hmm. right? How very quickly the temperature can shoot to astronomical scorching heights. And then also if we keep in mind that when a jet engine is in a jet, it's usually very high in the air, and that high altitude causes a lower temperature.
Yeah, you know, that's something that I was thinking about early this morning when I was driving into work, actually. I was thinking, okay, these things are working. They're operating at 35, 40,000 feet, whatever it happens to be, even higher.
Mm-hmm.
It's much, much colder up there, obviously.
Yeah,
much
absolutely.
I mean, unsurvivable cold, right?
Mm-hmm.
What must the temperatures be like down here on the surface of the Earth
right,
for this
right.
thing? I mean, how are they getting that thing to operate? I mean, I would think that there's got to be a lot of engineering going on, saying
sure.
for lack of a better way to say it, of how are we going to make this thing operate without just absolutely destroying itself in 10 seconds?
Some real impressive mad science there.
Mm-hmm.
These fuels that are typically divided into two rough umbrella groups, one for civilian purposes, one for military purposes. Now, the military equivalents will have some extra stuff added in, just some extra goodies,
a little bit
we'll add in. And that'll be stuff like a real quick list here. We'll have stuff like anti-knock additives, and these reduce the tendency of the gasoline to detonate. And this is where we have stuff like tetraethyl lead. So if you've ever been like me and you're at the gas station and you think, why on earth do we still have unleaded
mm-hmm.
on all the gas station signs? That's because there are still lead additives. They're just probably not going to be in your Volvo. They're going to be in, you know, jets. They're going to be in some higher grade industrial applications.
Got it.
Static dissipators reduce the hazardous effects of static electricity. Antioxidants, not the nutrition antioxidants, rather the ones that prevent the formation of gum deposits on components as the fuel oxidizes in storage.
Good for your heart,
yes. Biocide additives, this is a little bit different. This is one I didn't know about. They combat microbiological growths in jet fuel.
Ah, no algae.
No algae. Icing inhibitors, that makes sense, reducing the freezing point of water precipitated from the fuels because of high altitudes.
Got it.
Corrosion inhibitors, thermal stability improvers.
Hmm.
The list goes on. And, again, this is all designed to satisfy a couple of purposes, to make sure that the engine components do not corrode, that the fuel does not undergo some sort of change that renders it dangerous to the system. And, of course, let's not forget the pilot and the passengers. They're usually, as you said, thousands of feet in the air.
Yeah. Hey, you know what?
Yeah.
One quick thing here. I'm
yes.
going to sidetrack this a bit.
Let's go.
Did you ever hear of anybody saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to go out to the airport and get some jet fuel for my car for this weekend, like for racing or whatever it happens to be? It sounds like, I mean, from what you've mentioned, it sounds like it probably wouldn't even burn in a car.
You know, I have never personally tried to put jet fuel in the old Monte Carlo.
Now, I know there's extremely high-octane fuels you can buy for racing.
Yes.
And we know that that won't really necessarily do anything great for your Ford Escort, you know, or whatever it happens to be that runs on unleaded,
right.
typical, you know, low-grade unleaded or mid-grade even.
Good point.
Because we talked about, you know, how octane, in the past we talked about this,
right.
high-octane just means that it's harder to burn.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily a good thing for an engine that doesn't call for it if it has low compression.
Absolutely.
So, you know, a lot of cases people are wasting money by doing that, and actually makes your engine run much more poorly.
Oh, and point, I guess as a side to the side note, if you have a vehicle with manufacturer recommendations for something like only premium fuel,
mm-hmm.
don't mess around, dude.
No, use it.
Use it.
Use
don't
it for
don't
sure.
go cheap. Don't pull a Ben Bolin.
Yeah.
You will regret it.
But don't go get jet fuel either.
Yeah, don't
see that's a thing. Like I just can't picture it. I can't picture it actually working now that I know a little bit about it.
Right, right. And now that we have talked a little bit about what a jet engine is,
mm-hmm.
what fuels a jet engine,
mm-hmm.
which types of jet engines there are, the
yep.
basic process, and we've also have we included our shameless
oh.
plug? We have. Okay.
Yep.
One more thing.
One more quick thing, I think.
Yeah.
Or do we want to wait until we get to the bicycle discussion?
Okay, let's wait.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So now let's jump. Feet first, head first, into the types of vehicles that you can, against all the manufacturer recommendations, put a jet engine on.
Yeah, that's right. All safety recommendations, against what your mother told you.
Oh, gosh.
How about that? That's probably a better way to say it.
Against what we would have told you if you asked us.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there's a lot of exhibition vehicles, racing vehicles that you'll find that have jet engines in them.
Sure.
Some that you wouldn't expect. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an easy one to find online. You just search for jet-powered engines or jet-powered vehicles, rather, and you'll find a variety of things. And I did just that. I looked at a lot of photographs over the last few days. Mm-hmm. I found some remarkable ones. I mean, there's some that, you know, there's a little bit more information about than others, and some are more typical than others. So, you know, you're going to see or you're going to hear a few of these that you will say, oh, of course, I've seen that before, but maybe, you know, you'll want to search out some of these and take a look.
Mm-hmm. And heck, you might be one of the people who owns one of these.
Yeah, you know what? Tell you what.
Yes.
I've been doing a lot of talking. Why don't you hit us with your list of what you've got there, and then I'll just try to fill in some gaps here and there.
Okay, let's see. Let's.
I do want to get to the Thrust SSC at the end with the
that's
the
it. Land We're saving that one for the end
because that's really cool, and that's probably one of the greatest achievements on land. I would say I think I can say that without a doubt.
Absolutely,
that's the land speed record holder, right?
I agree with you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's the land speed record holder, and if this stuff works out, it's going to be a new threshold.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean in land speed history.
For the Bloodhound. Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's start off with something easy. You're familiar with a Toyota MR2.
Yes, I am.
And I'm showing you a picture here where someone added two GE T58 turbines.
That's ridiculous.
That is, you know, MR2s are no slouches anyway.
Yeah,
they're good cars.
I got to believe that that is nothing more than just an MR2 shell placed on top of two jet engines, the way that looks. How scary would that be to sit in front of those?
No idea. It reminds me of, do you remember when we covered that the concept car, the original turbine-powered car?
Yes.
That this reminds me a little bit of that.
The Chrysler turbine.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So one thing that's funny is if you see here on the information that we got off here, it was auctioned on eBay in 2005.
Boy.
Can you just read that tagline there for everybody? This is what they put on there.
It says everybody needs one of these.
You know.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to send this to my boss.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful street legal jet-powered Beetle. Have you heard about this?
I've actually seen video of this one running.
Yeah, you can find video of this online. Mm-hmm. It's by an engineer named Ron Patrick. And Ron did something I thought was very smart, especially in comparison to some of the other vehicles we're about to discuss. Ron put a dual engine arrangement in his vehicle that's why he can legally drive it on public roads.
I see. So he's not using the jet power necessarily at all times.
At all times, yeah.
Ah, okay. He's using the old standard ICE engine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Excellent work, Mr. Patrick.
Very cool.
And there's some beautiful footage of this vehicle. There are some up-close videos of this vehicle, and you can take a closer look at how he's modified the dash, how he has mounted the engine, the jet engine, to allow for the when a jet engine is heating up, it expands, grows.
Yeah.
So he's cleverly set this up. I thought this was a great job. I think you might be smiling because you see the next thing down there.
I do. Yeah, yeah, that's ridiculous.
That is a jet-powered. It's a jet-powered wheelchair. I don't know how I'll say it. It's got car tires. The two rear wheels are usually larger, are car tires. That's called the Allegro Medical, and it's a concept wheelchair. So
I think medical is what you'll need after you run this thing because that looks dangerous.
I didn't find footage of this actually running, and I think it is just a concept.
I'm sure there's a good reason why it wasn't actually running.
Right.
That looks scary.
I would hope so.
It does look scary.
It is scary. It's
A lot of these terrify me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think mainly because of the heat involved.
Yes, because again, that's such a fatal amount of heat.
It really is. Yeah. It's
scary. This vehicle, the concept wheelchair, built by Giuseppe Canella of England, his mother-in-law has Parkinson's, and so this vehicle was made for her, and put on shows in the wheelchair to raise money for the Parkinson's Disease Society.
Oh, okay.
So it's for a good cause.
Okay, I get it now. I thought he wanted his mother to use it.
No, he's a good guy.
Yeah,
he's a good guy.
That wouldn't be nice.
And you've seen this. This has been making the rounds over the internet.
Oh, yeah.
This is legally, I think, the fastest leather recliner roller or rocker, excuse me. Remember in that earlier podcast we were talking about how the Texas Mile has so many subcategories?
Sure.
It's possible to win in.
Yeah.
This is another one that's carefully qualified world's best.
I bet it could be the world's fastest.
And let's see, we've also got, gosh, we got this thing billed as, well, I'm going to call this the MiG fire truck. This is the one
cool.
that I'm proudest of.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
A MiG jet engine in a fire truck.
Yep. 27-foot-long Russian MiG fighter jet in the back of a fire truck.
Wait. 27-foot-long?
So they had to one small engineering difficulty. They had to take out the water tanks. So this might be the first fire truck on the scene.
The only thing, it would actually cause fires if it were to ignite.
Well, hey now. It's got the people who would be in this vehicle are surely the best equipped to deal with any fire that might pop up.
Yeah. That's not just an exhibition vehicle, I'm sure.
And it's not the only emergency vehicle that has a jet because there is, as you saw in this lower page here, there's an ambulance.
Uh-huh.
It's powered by a GJ79 jet engine. And
General Electric, huh? General Electric engine in an ambulance with lots of fire coming out of the back. Looks like there's no room for any passengers.
Well, that's cool. Maybe they could ride in the jet-powered porta-potty.
You know, it's a porta-potty. Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, that's one that
I don't know.
I got a little bit of information about the porta potty here if you want to hear it.
Yeah.
It's actually called the Jet Outhouse, and it's run by a couple of guys. I think it is a company, anyway. It's called the Indie Boys.
Oh, yeah. Paul Stender, right?
Yeah, that's right. Paul Stender. And he's a builder driver who kind of builds these custom hot rods, custom bikes, jet powered vehicles. And they've got they got five of them. Actually, as a matter of fact, they got five jet-powered vehicles that they run as exhibition vehicles at different events. You may be a racing thing, a drag strip or whatever.
Are they all outhouses?
No, they're not all outhouses, Ben. But there's the outhouse, if I can tell you, that outhouse has the equivalent of 1,000 horsepower.
That's amazing.
That is. I don't know how you could, you know, be in that thing. It looks like it would topple over. It's very tall. But, you know, spitting flames. It has, you know, capability to shoot out 30-foot flames.
Yeah.
And a top speed of 70 miles per hour. Now, that doesn't sound too fast when you consider it as 1,000 horsepower, but when you look at this thing...
At the shape of an outhouse.
I would imagine the shape of an outhouse going 70 miles an hour. Not too steady, I wouldn't think. So 70 miles an hour is pretty good, actually. Now, some of the other vehicles they have,
Ben,
if you want to just talk about the other four quickly, they have a jet school bus. Which is always a crowd pleaser.
Uh-huh.
80-foot flames are capable from this thing. Again, it has a General Electric J-79 jet engine that comes from a McDonnell Douglas F-4 Phantom fighter jet. Very impressive. 42,000 horsepower, Ben. Top speed, get this, 367 miles per hour is the top speed that this jet school bus can achieve. So you can imagine it's not like a typical school bus. It's lowered. It's got, you know, a steel frame and everything. It's very, very, well, safe for the driver, I guess. They also have a jet Humvee, which has the, I believe it has the same engine. It's 42,000 horsepower, 350 mile an hour Humvee.
Oh, wow. Somewhere right now, let's see, who's doing it? Right now, Kanye West is listening to the podcast and stopped it so he could get on the phone and say, get me that. Get
that's
me that Humvee.
Yeah, that's right. I need that Humvee. Yeah, so 42,000 horsepower, 350 miles an hour. They also have a jet Jeep, which is a 200 mile per hour, 30-foot flame. Looks like an old military Jeep, very low, very cool looking. And then maybe, I don't know, this one's maybe one of the more interesting ones.
Okay.
No top speeds listed for this one or anything, but they have a 1967 Impala that they call the Urban Legend 67 Jet Impala. And they have really, it looks like it's just a jet engine strapped to the hood of this thing, the top of it. You remember the old Urban Legend, the Jado Jet or whatever they called it, Jado Rocket. So they call it the Urban Legend 67 Jet Impala, and that one makes its, you know, the show rounds, I guess.
Yeah, that's definitely an exhibition.
So the Indie Boys, they have a ton of vehicles that you can find all over
history.
The place. And you can call and arrange to have them come out and, you know,
see,
run something at your event.
Oh, okay. I was going to say have the – I thought perhaps you were going to say that you could have the Indie Boys come check out your project vehicle.
Oh, maybe.
And say maybe we could put a jet on that.
I'm sure you could put a jet on just about anything, you know, according to what we've seen here.
I want to tell you about this, the M497 jet-powered train.
I love the way that looks.
It looks beautiful. Yeah. These vehicles, like, we're culling these from an assortment of different jet-powered vehicles articles that you can find online. You can delve into, in some cases, like the Indie Boys case, you can delve into the work of the creators and find more stuff. What's fascinating even about jet-powered trains is that for a time, innovators and even larger companies were experimenting with alternate propulsion methods for trains. Mm-hmm. Now, ultimately, this work hasn't been all for nothing, because we know that there are some amazing high-speed trains in the world today. They're maglev trains. Mm-hmm. They're things that, you know, 20, 30 years ago would have looked like Star Trek material.
Yeah.
Now, we have, for different reasons, not always been able to succeed with these. Like, we know that the pneumatic tube system for public transit in New York didn't work out that well. And we know that they're not jet-powered trains like this thing around anymore. But this was cool, and this was from the 60s. It's got a U.S. Air Force, a General Electric J-47 jet engine, and it's got a bomber engine pod, top speed of 183. I'm going to round up to 184.
That's pretty quick for back then.
This is in the 60s.
I've also got to tell you, Ben, like these trains, like older trains, they look cool alone. They're very streamlined, very nice looking.
Yeah.
To add jet engines on top of these things with the pods that they include, it somehow fits. It seems to work.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I think it's not a terrible way to propel a train, really. I mean, I'm sure that there's some type of flaw in the reason.
Sure.
I mean, I know that there's a flaw in the reason why they didn't do it. But, rather than have a giant diesel engine, driving a metal wheel on a metal track, if you can have the metal wheels just simply be rollers and brakes, and then you've got this jet that's providing all the thrust on top, it seems like the concept seems like it would work.
A rocket sled on rails.
Exactly. Yeah. It seems like it would work. And I don't know what the problem was with them. I'll have to delve into that a little deeper.
Maybe we can look at it.
Do a whole podcast on jet-powered trains, because there's quite a few of them out there, and I'd say they all look pretty cool.
Now we're going to go to something that you and I were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
That we really want to talk about. These the vehicles we've named so far seem pretty interesting, because in some cases we're looking at a vehicle like that Beetle has an enormous engine that protrudes from the rear of the vehicle, and it might make you think, based on just casual observation, it might make you think that the tricky thing about using jet engines on vehicles is that the jet engines are too big. But that's not the case.
Yeah, they could be face melters.
They could be face melters.
Yeah, they could be in traffic. And you know, anybody walking nearby these things, I mean, it's going to damage somebody. They're better left on the racetracks and exhibition courses, things like that. They're for show.
That's true. There are, however, some specific types of jet engines that you could even fit on a bicycle.
Are you going to say this is a practical use of jet engines?
I'm not.
Because I think you kind of wanted to say this, the others were absurd. This is practical.
I don't
want
to say it's practical.
Okay, so there's a guy who's kind of infamous now. What's his name? I'm not sure. You can take a look. But
is it Andy Tyler?
Andy Tyler. Yeah, he is kind of known for putting a different type of jet engine on cruiser type bicycles. The kind of the big fat tires and the big wide seats and the really cool fenders and everything. A small jet engine on the edge of one of these things to propel it. And people love these things. They look really cool, because I like the old bikes anyways. I mean, I guess we're kind of back in the old trains and how they look cool.
Right, the jet engine. But here's
the old bikes, and they've got a jet engine on the side, which looks more like just a metal tube. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not really the typical jet engine that you would think of, like, that's underneath an aircraft wing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is just a metal tube.
I'm sorry, Bob Maddox is
the guy who does
the old school bicycles. Andy Tyler does shopping carts.
Okay, so there's another vehicle we can just get out of.
But your point is correct.
Shopping carts.
These look like tubes.
Because, of course, you need a jet-powered shopping cart.
Well, look, man, the grocery stores are just getting bigger.
Okay, so the tube you're talking about is a pulse jet.
Yes, a pulse jet engine.
And that's a different type of jet engine. Now, I don't have a lot of details about the pulse jet right now. Mm-hmm. I know we need to dig into this, but you know, as you can tell, we've got a lot of information in this podcast. So the pulse jet is maybe something for later. But just basically, it's still an internal combustion engine. Mm-hmm. There's very few moving parts. Actually, some of them are constructed with no moving parts. And believe mm-hmm. it or not, there may be a reed valve or something inside them. They were developed early in the 1900s, and for the most part, they were actually cruise missile power. That's how the cruise missiles were delivered. And, of course, they're very loud. Mm-hmm. They make a lot of noise. There's two different types. There's a valved pulse jet. There's a valveless pulse jet. They can be anything from, you know, really small in size to very large. You can have, you know, some that propel. A lot of hobbyists use these.
Right.
Just as an example, they use them to power little cars, little you know, jets, of course, you know, hobby jets. RC jets, or you can use them for boats. You know, whatever your hobby happens to be, you can use these to power them. And the good news is, Ben, you can actually build these on your own. If you go online, there are instructional videos and diagrams and charts and, you know, whatever you need in order, and parts lists in order to go out to the hardware store and pick up everything you need to build a pulse jet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this guy does it. He does it very professionally. I mean, it's very well done. It's not like something he just... It doesn't look like something he built in his garage. It looks like it's, you know, it's well done. They look really cool, and I think pulse jets are something that, you know, I don't know. They've got a lot of range in them. They can burn almost anything. Anything.
Yes.
You know, can you burn alcohol? I saw some that burn coal dust. Mm-hmm. Anything that's combustible can be burned in a pulse jet.
But the one let's not call it an out and out flaw, but one thing to consider with these pulse jets is that they burn through that stuff very quickly.
Very quickly.
So, for instance, Mr. Andy Tyler, with his, he also found these instructions on the internet to build his jet.
Okay, so this is the shopping cart guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this guy, yeah, the shopping cart guy, and his shopping cart runs out of fuel after about 2 minutes.
Okay.
And this is one of the things that's the nature of. I'm not saying don't build your own jet powered, you know, bar stool or something.
Yeah.
But I am saying, don't think it's going to be able to drive you to California from the East Coast on a tank of gas.
Yeah, can I? Okay.
Yeah.
I have to stop you here again.
Yes.
Now, we've got a list of just a couple quick things we want to get through, and we're getting near the end of this, I promise.
Right,
But I do want to mention that I've seen jet-powered vehicles run. I've seen them live. I've seen them, you know, in person. I've also seen them online, and there's some, I guess, some typical attributes to these things that, you know, you can expect to see when you see one of these things.
Oh, this is perfect. Yeah.
One thing that always surprises me is that they're relatively slow to start.
Yes, now, which you wouldn't think.
Yeah. Now, it's not like, you know, on an aircraft carrier when they're launching a jet off of the thing and, you know, they're actually propelling the jet, because, you know, that's what I think of when I think of jet power. I think instant power. This thing's taken off.
Instant lift.
It's almost top speed. Well, not top speed, but it's close, you know, takeoff speed immediately. That's not really. No, that's the function of the aircraft carrier propelling that thing.
Uh-huh.
Because the jet is firing, sure. But they have these vehicles that, you know, they run them at drag strips or they run them at raceways. They have a relatively slow start. They may have a tremendous top speed.
Right. But low initial acceleration.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and it's you got to imagine that, you know, you're trying to controlling that thrust. It's not like you're you know, in a car at a drag strip when you hit the gas and, you know, all hell breaks loose and, you know, the wheels are, you know, they're gripping the pavement and it's instant power.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like that. You're pushing air behind you and you slowly start to ramp up and then once it does take, you know, it moves. It really does move quick. But I got to tell you, I've seen these in person. Not to be disrespectful, but they're just not that impressive.
Well, there are a couple of other things. I'm glad you're saying this, because one of the questions that I had when I was looking at the, granted, amazing possibilities for these vehicles, and the idea that you can build an engine on almost anything, and because of the smaller size, you can really have some engineering leeway. I wondered why these weren't on more vehicles, and there are a couple of problems. One is that initial acceleration. Another one, now I know everybody knew I was going to say this because I am kind of cheap. They're very expensive.
Yes.
Any way you look at it in comparison to an ICE.
Yeah, they burn a ton of fuel.
And they're less than half as fuel efficient as your typical gas engine.
Expensive just for the components that come together and to make them work and make them work safely and to be able to get them to actually operate in the vehicle of choice. You know, to be able to mount them in there and have them safely, you know, to be able to safely tuck everything away where it needs to be, keep the driver safe, keep people around the vehicle safe. It's complex. And there's a lot that goes into this. I mean, a lot of planning, a lot of effort. So I don't mean to shoot them down completely, but when I say they're not impressive, what I mean is that in the space that I've been able to see them run, they're not impressive. If you get them out to the salt flats, very impressive.
Oh yeah.
But if you get them on let's say a racetrack, they typically the first one I ever saw was at a NASCAR truck race.
Okay.
In the late 90s, and it was a semi truck that had a huge jet engine sticking on the back, and it was really cool to see this thing operate. And it was all hyped all weekend and everything.
Sure.
And they were going to run it down the main stretch, and it was all again lots of hype around this thing. But when it got to the starting line, or the main stretch, it did a couple of these real quick bursts of power, like where smoke and fire comes out of the back, and that was awesome. That was really, really cool. Loud and everything, just everything you'd expect. It was howling.
Yeah.
And you think, this thing is really going to go. And it has a top speed of like 350 miles an hour, and it's a massive semi-truck, right?
Yeah.
So, and the guy's got the parachutes on the back and everything. Well, he backs up to the very end of the straight, down by turn four, kind of lets it open up, and it whistles and it screams and slowly builds up speed, and then before you know it, he's shutting it down. And I'm thinking, man, this is not that it wasn't 350. That wasn't all that impressive. What happened? Well, the problem is there's that turn one wall that's
right
in front of him, and
yeah,
he's got to turn left. And you're not going to be able to turn left going 350 miles an hour in a semi.
No.
So I understand why, you have to have a lot of space for these. Even on a drag strip, by the time they really get it going, it's time to shut it down. Yeah, it's not like the Texas Mile where you got, a mile to run and then a half mile to shut down, which, by the way, wouldn't be enough for these vehicles. They need even more space than that because, if you're going 350 at the end of that mile, the cars that we saw, they were running off into the gravel. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to shut down, even with some had parachutes, and they were trying to shut down.
Like a half mile.
Yeah, they had a half mile, and they're still getting into the gravel. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine going 350 and trying to shut it down in a half mile. It just wouldn't work.
Yeah.
So there's restrictions. These are impressive, but they're not impressive in the way that they can be displayed to the public typically. So, like, when you see one at a racetrack, you got to give them a little bit of leeway and understand that, it's just impressive that they've done what they've done.
Yeah, so you're not in any way, criticizing this. If anything, you're defending it by pointing out that the circumstances and the constraints for the safety constraints mainly for these vehicles is such that you're not really going to see them open up with their full-on capacities unless you're in a place where, honestly, they have like 2 or 3 miles to stop.
Let's just say unlimited space.
We'll call it unlimited space,
and then they're very impressive.
Yeah.
As long as they can hold up under that speed, the tires, et cetera. But I mean, like, there's people that put them in a Model T, a Dodge Caravan, a Vespa.
Vespa.
There's of course, boats.
Right.
There's a tank. It's a drag car that actually is made to look like a tank, like it has treads, but it's really run on wheels. Let's see. There's monorail type vehicles, which are kind of like the train idea, and I love the way these look. Very futuristic, really cool looking.
My favorite episode of The Simpsons, by the way.
Oh yeah, the monorail.
The monorail.
Yeah, that's
one?
Right. Yeah, I like the song.
Yeah.
Let's see. So there's scooters, jet powered. Oh, the you ever heard the vehicle they call the Flatmobile?
What is the Flatmobile?
The Flatmobile that's about 19 inches high. It kind of looks like, and they've actually kind of made it look like the Batmobile.
Okay.
And that, but it's really cool. It's just a little 19 inch high vehicle, but that's jet powered. Let's see. There's motorcycles, of course, trains.
Yeah.
You mentioned those garden tractors. A lot of garden tractors out there. You'll find that people.
That is true.
Yeah, for some reason, garden tractors.
I wonder how that happens.
I don't know, but there's groups of people that love to go out to old airstrips and run their jet powered garden tractors.
There's all. I bet here's how it happens. I bet there's some lady or some guy and they've found ways to build a small jet engine online, and they've built it, and they're thinking, well, now I have it. What am I going to do with it? Mm-hmm. I can't just keep it on this stand in the garage forever. And they're looking around, and they're looking, and then boom, garden tractor.
Yep, suddenly they got a an online group that has the same idea, and they head out to the local airfield.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay, there's go-karts, there's boats, there's mm-hmm. There's just a ton of vehicles, so I think we're getting a little long on this.
Let's go to the Bloodhound.
Let's go to the Thrust first.
Because, let's go to the Thrust.
Bloodhound is kind of the final chapter. Mm-hmm. We've got one that right now is the Thrust SSC is the one that holds the record.
Yes.
So there's a lot of impressive information about the Thrust, and I feel like we talked about this in the past, but let's just quickly talk about it because, again, it's a jet-powered vehicle. It has two Rolls-Royce turbojet engines.
Yes. It's a monster. This thing is a monster.
Oh, my gosh. The top speed. Do you believe this, Ben? The top speed. Well, actually, the average for two runs was 763 miles an hour.
And the driver is still alive, everyone.
Yes.
Or should we call him the pilot?
Andy Green, who is, I think he's been called officially the fastest man on Earth, right?
Yeah.
Instead of the sprinter, right?
Right. Instead of the sprinter, this guy.
Yeah, yeah. So this guy is actually truly the fastest man mm-hmm. on Earth because this is a land speed record. The vehicle wasn't flying. It was on the ground. It weighs 10 tons. And get this, Ben, the thrust amount. You remember we talked about thrust and horsepower equivalent?
Yes.
This thing has the equivalent, if you can picture this, the equivalent of 145 Formula One cars. That's the kind of power we're talking about in these two engines. So the first ever supersonic world record,
right.
World land speed record.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a long time ago now. It was 1997 that this thing was run. So this record has stood for a long, long time.
Yes.
Black Rock Desert in Nevada. I don't know. This car, nothing about it is unimpressive, if that makes sense.
Yes.
when you look at anything around this car, there's something about the wheels are really cool. Mm-hmm. There's a whole story about the wheels.
We covered some of that in our earlier podcast on the fastest ever vehicle.
Yeah, that's right. And the solid metal wheels. I forget what they're made of. Titanium or something like that.
Yeah. So here's the problem. It's a problem they face with the Thrust and that the same group is facing with the Bloodhound.
Okay.
How do we make these tires or wheels that will hold on under such tremendous pressures and not be damaged by, a pebble in the road?
Yeah.
Because at these speeds, a pebble in the road could end Mr. Green's career.
Yeah, they are looking at the course very carefully mm-hmm. to make sure that there's nothing in the way, nothing that obstructs this thing during its run. Let's just go ahead and tell them I'm ready to kind of wrap this thing up.
Okay, go for it.
Because, the Bloodhound is going to run, supposedly, it's going to run sometime later this year or mm-hmm. early next year.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be happening anytime soon that this record is going to break. Now, we're talking about breaking a record. The Thrust SSC ran at a maximum of 766 miles an hour, but the record, the average record is 763. They're going to top that, Ben.
Yeah, they're hoping to top it.
I mean, big. They're gonna top it by like 25%.
They're hoping to exceed 1,000 miles per hour.
That is incredible. Can you imagine traveling? I've
on
seen the video
the whole time.
I've seen the video of the 763. Mm-hmm. They've got a lot of cameras were online. For this, there was a helicopter camera where the thing just shot past the helicopter. There's video of it going past. A stationary object.
Yeah.
There's the cameras on board. Amazing footage. 1,000 miles an hour.
And
I can't imagine.
This means, Scott, that for every second, if this all works out, for every second, the Bloodhound will cover almost 1,500 feet. So that means every one Mississippi, it's going almost 5 football fields.
Oh, my gosh.
So
that's incredible.
Talk about what we said earlier, where you just need to assume that there's unlimited space.
Yeah.
Like this vehicle would pretty much be a death trap on any racetrack. There's no way you could even do it.
There's no facility that could contain that.
Right. And I don't know if we could even build one. So it has to have carbon fiber, titanium bodywork. It's got to – they're thinking that it's going to accelerate from 0 to 1,050 miles per hour in 40 seconds.
Oh, my gosh. That has got to be quite a rush.
God only knows. It's 42 feet long. It weighs just over 14,000 pounds.
Wow.
I mean, this thing is a beast.
So, that's 7 tons. That's lighter than the thrust.
Because
the thrust is 10 tons.
Yeah.
So you're talking about at least 22,000 pounds. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, so they've trimmed it down.
Wow. It's going to be the downforce pressure is going to be like 12 tons per square meter.
Wow.
So,
again, like
who
I said,
knows?
Everything about these vehicles, these land speed record vehicles, is impressive. I used to like to read about the Bluebird, mm-hmm. that when Craig Breedlove ran back in the early 1970s. That type of vehicle, I just loved just looking at those photographs. They were amazing, and the speeds were half of what we're seeing now.
And we can only assume that with these improvements in technology, and especially not to be anybody's. Not to play dad to anybody, but especially the safety technology, we can assume that we're going to see some very, very fast things coming up in the future here.
I think about I'm going to maybe look up the pulse jet information, try to put a pulse jet on my office chair.
I think that's a great idea, Scott.
What would you put a pulse jet on?
I would probably put a pulse jet on the back of a hang glider, if I could figure out how to do it without burning up the hang glider.
So a glider that's now powered.
So yes.
It'd be a jet.
So it would be glider jet. Jet glider.
Okay, so it's a jet.
Oh, come on.
You just make your own jet.
Have the James Bond estate call me.
I've
got some ideas.
A small pulse jet on a kite.
That's nice.
That way you don't need any wind.
Or one of those those little red wagons they used to give to kids.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I would be arrested.
Or how about the old red bug cars that we talked about? The you know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah, the buckboard cars.
Yeah, what about a
pulse jet on a buckboard car?
If we put it on a go-kart, they've already done that. That's almost the same thing.
It is the same thing.
Listen, this isn't a bad idea.
I do have a go-kart, and I would love to have a jet-powered go-kart.
And honestly, this probably isn't the best idea we've ever had. But we better wrap this up, Scott. We better get out of here. Everybody, thanks so much for listening. We want to hear from you. We want to know what you would put a jet on. Check out these pulse jet engines. We might even check these out in an upcoming podcast because they're pretty versatile. You can put these on a lot of things. Not that we're saying that you should. Not that we're taking any legal responsibility.
No, but if you do happen to do that, just send us some photographs.
Yeah, we would love to see it if you happen to do it of your own volition. And you can write to us on our Facebook page. You can give us a shout out on Twitter, although it can't be too verbose because it's Twitter. And if you would like to tell us more about your experience with jet-powered vehicles of any sort, send us an email at
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.